So are you ready to talk about football? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk with the author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game this hour. And we'll wonder if you agree with him that there is an unfair attack on football taking place, or if you disagree with him, if you think that that football is unsafe and needs to be carefully monitored. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So how do you feel about football? Is it too dangerous for kids and teenagers? Or does the risk of a contact sport like football do more harm than good? Do you worry about concussions or chronic brain diseases that could result? Our guest says that overall, football is a safe sport, and all of these various claims are overblown. Daniel Flynn is with us. He writes frequently for The American Spectator and blogs at flynnfiles.com. His most recent book is The War on Football, Saving America's Game. Good morning.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So what do you mean by the war on football? Who's waging war on football?
Well, just last week, the oldest tackle football league in America was shut down by a principal at Lawrenceville Prep in New Jersey. And this league had been going on for 124 years. And because of the chain of events in the year 2013, they decided to shut down this league at a local high school near where I live in Newton, Massachusetts. Every year, there is what's called a powder puff game between the junior and senior girls at this high school. It's a flag football game, but even the flag football game gets caught up in the war on football, and the headmaster at that school has shut down the powder puff game every year. And so you see these little examples around the country, whether they be, you know, school committee members in New Hampshire or Philadelphia saying, you know, let's ban football in the high schools, or their state legislators. There was a state legislator in New York earlier this year who wanted to ban tackle football for kids under 11. And I think what most of your listeners probably don't understand is that football, you know, we process it as a game played between giant men, but in reality, football is a kid's game. It's a boy's game. You know, if you 19 out of every 20 football players can't legally vote or buy alcohol. This is almost all of the people who are playing it are kids. But I think because the NFL is so dominant in the national consciousness, we think of it as just this game of giants when it's something other than that.
Well, aren't these school committees and headmasters and local lawmakers concerned about kids hurting themselves, and that's why they're taking these actions?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's their concern. I don't think football has become particularly hard or rough. I think society has become especially soft. And so the old concern about football is that you would have players actually dying on the field. And so in 1968, which was the height of the football violence, and it was the height of a lot of violence in America, whether you're talking about what was going on in Vietnam or the bombings and the assassinations at home. So football kind of got lost amidst all that. But you had 36 players dying from football hits at all levels of competition in 1968. Last season, we had two players at all levels of competition dying. So by the measurable measure, football is getting a lot safer. More kids died by getting struck by lightning playing football last year than died by getting struck by other players. And to me, that sort of demonstrates the hysteria surrounding the game, that it's a relatively safe sport, not just compared to its own history, it's getting much safer, getting dramatically safer, but compared to other activities that we allow kids to engage in, football is relatively safe. I mean, if you look last week, for instance, there was headlines when Joy Covey, the old chief financial officer of Amazon.com, died in a bicycling accident. But it's only when someone is a celebrity do we hear of someone dying in a bike accident. And yet every week, you know, I checked, and I think there were a dozen other people in America who were killed, mostly by traumatic brain injuries, bicycling in America. We don't think of bicycling as a violent activity, and it certainly isn't, but it's a much more dangerous activity, much more dangerous than football. But I don't hear any voices out there saying we should ban football or we should prohibit kids from playing football. You know, it's just until very recently that we decided that it's a good idea to wear helmets while bicycling. So I think we process sports differently, partly because of the intent of football sometimes. You know, that nose guard does want to drive the quarterback into the ground. He has some malicious intent. And the intent of that SUV in front of you while you're bicycling, it may not be to hit you, but it may hit you nonetheless. And certainly the playing surface in bicycling, the asphalt, is a lot less forgiving than the playing surface in football. The speed involved is much greater in bicycling. So I think football has a bad reputation, partly because the intent of football is no doubt, it's rough, it's violent. And it may not be rough and violent in bicycling and skateboarding and skiing, but they're more deadly activities nonetheless.
Right. I think you misspoke when you said you are not hearing anybody say, let's ban football. You said you meant biking. People are saying
That's right.
Yeah, people are saying let's ban football.
I don't hear anyone. Yeah. That's right.
And there are calls to ban football. Who's saying that?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, you know, probably the loudest is from Malcolm Gladwell, who's, you know, famous writer for The New Yorker and wrote The Tipping Point and other famous books. And he went to the University of Pennsylvania earlier this year and asked the students to protest football games and also to demand that the administration, get rid of the sport because, you know, from the way he puts it, universities are places that you're supposed to build brains and football is a game that destroys brains. And I think a lot of that, particularly the talk around concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, has been overblown. With regard to concussions, even the people studying the issue the most, you know, the closest, are not, you know, they don't really have a bead on concussions. So to give you an example, one scholarly article last year claimed that we have 300,000 sports-related concussions annually. There's another scholarly article that says we have as many as 3.8 million sports-related concussions annually. So even on something as basic as a count, the people who study concussions the most intensely, they don't have a clue. On chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the neurodegenerative brain disease that I'm sure your listeners have heard a lot about, it was found in the brain of Junior Seau and Dave Duerson and other players who have committed suicide. There has yet to even be a randomized scientific study or longitudinal study on chronic traumatic encephalopathy. In other words, there are a number of case studies, there are a number of autopsies on brains that were donated because the families of those players believed those players to be brain damaged. So there's a selection bias there. But there's no randomization. We have no sense in which how much chronic traumatic encephalopathy occurs amongst the general population, how much occurs amongst contact sports. And indeed, there has been a huge backlash in the scientific community with just three academic articles this past summer, stating that there is no scientific link between contact sports and CTE. There's no scientific link between CTE and suicide. And there has yet to even be a study, wondering about these links, let alone, a study proving it.
Yeah, but there is scientific evidence that concussions are nothing to sneeze at, and that while you might not die on the football field, a concussion can cause brain damage that will be with you for the rest of your life. Isn't that something we should worry about?
I think we should worry about concussions. One of the things that I discovered in writing this book is that, the so-called, revelations that we've had about concussions are actually, things that we've known for years. And in fact, concussion science really hasn't advanced all that much in the last century. I mean, if you look back to probably the biggest hit in NFL history, one of the most famous hits is when Chuck Bednarik hit Frank Gifford in 1962, knocked him out of consciousness in a Yankee stadium when the Eagles were playing the New York Giants. These are two Hall of Famers. And Gifford was taken off the field in a stretcher. And this hit inspired probably one of the best football books, which is called The Fan's Notes by Frederick Exley. just a, you know, a huge event in the history of the National Football League. Well, the reaction to what happened there with Frank Gifford, I think is a lot more prudent than the reaction that happens to concussions in the NFL today. If you look this past week, Monday Night Football, when Terrell Pryor, the quarterback of the Oakland Raiders, he suffered a concussion. He actually stayed in the game for a couple of plays, and then they took him out. And so this is causing a big controversy. If you compare that to what happened with Frank Gifford, Frank Gifford was put in the hospital for 2.5 weeks. They wouldn't let him out of the hospital after his concussion. He wanted to come back that season and play. The doctor said, under no circumstances can you come back this season and play. In fact, the following year, he stayed out of football. So the idea that, you know, just the day before yesterday, we figured out that concussions were dangerous, it doesn't mesh with the facts. It doesn't mesh with the story of Frank Gifford, and it doesn't mesh with other stories in football history that I uncovered in my book, The War on Football.
Yeah. What about the NFL, or at least the players union of the NFL, has teamed up with Harvard University to study statistics that say that football players die nearly 20 years earlier on average than other American men. How about that one?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that George Will and Malcolm Gladwell and Elsie Granderson and other really famous writers have repeated in their columns over the past year. And what bothers me about that is that, you know, besides the fact that it's an urban myth and there's no basis in fact for it, is that last May, the National Institutes for Occupational Safety and Health did a study on every NFL player who played between 1959 and 1988, all of the pension-vested players who played in at least a game or so in five or more seasons. And so what they found, I should add that the NFL Players Association asked these federal scientists to conduct this study, to conduct this mortality study. What they found was rather stunning to the NFL Players Association, and that is that football players actually live longer than their peers outside of the game. And there's sort of a duh quality to this study because, you know, if you run up and down a practice field for 2 hours every day, you're probably going to have healthier heart, healthier lungs. If you're, you know, if you have these dietary considerations, you're not smoking cigarettes, you have access to health care, all of this that goes along with being a professional football player, you know, what these scientists found is that the players had dramatically lower rates of heart disease, dramatically lower rates of cancer, particularly lung cancer. Respiratory illness was, you know, just a fraction of what it is amongst the public. And I think most surprising for this survey was that the suicide rate amongst NFL players is dramatically lower than the suicide rate amongst the public. We've heard a whole lot in the media, you know, when Junior Seau or Dave Duerson or Andre Waters, these great NFL players have taken their own lives, and it's been linked implicitly to playing football. But if football really caused suicide, why is it the case that the male peer group outside of football has a 2.5 times higher rate of suicide than NFL football players? So I think for most people, that federal study, the most shocking thing was that all of this hype surrounding NFL player suicides, it's just one of these, like, shark attack stories that we see at the end of every summer, or killer bees coming to get us, or the Y2K bug. It's a media creation. It has nothing to do with the reality of the situation.
We are talking with Daniel Flynn. He is the author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. He says the concerns about concussions and suicide and shortened lifespans of players are overblown and untrue. He is also concerned about the decreasing numbers of young people who are getting involved in the game. We'll talk about that as we move along, and we welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234, or we welcome your views on whether or not you think football is a dangerous sport or not, for kids or for adults. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Go, Pack, go! Well, we are talking about football and what our guest says is a war on football. And we're wondering if you think there's a war on football. How do you feel about football? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Daniel Flynn is the author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. And Daniel, I played that Go Pack Go because I have this Packer news to share that's related to your book. For the second straight week, the Green Bay Packers lost one of their top offensive players to a concussion. JerMichael Finley left Sunday's game after he got drilled by somebody on the Cincinnati Bengals. It looks like the Packers lost their running back, Eddie Lacy, to a concussion the week before. There are new safety rules in place, aren't there, in the NFL to try to avoid concussions, big penalties if you do the helmet-to-helmet hit or something?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the big new rule this year is that running backs who lower their heads when they're going, you know, taking on defensive players, they're going to be penalized 15 yards. Now, I don't object to any of this. I mean, there's some people who call themselves football purists, and any time there's a new rule instituted to protect the players, they cry foul. But the one thing that I discovered in looking over the history of football going back 144 years is that football is really a progressive game. It's an evolutionary game. It's unlike baseball and soccer. Those are sports that essentially are traditionalist games. If you took a baseball player, if you took Ty Cobb from playing 100 years ago, he could still play baseball and know the rules today. There'd be, you know, slight changes like the designated hitter, but it's essentially the same game. Football is totally different. When they started, they used a soccer ball, and they kicked the ball in a soccer goal. But at a certain point, they said, you know what, it's a lot more fun to kick it above the goal, and that's where you get the goalposts. And then the ball became elongated into a rugby ball. And after that 1905 season that saw so many players die on the field, and President Theodore Roosevelt holding actually a football summit at the White House, you had changes like the introduction of the neutral zone, no more forward motion for offensive players, no more, you know, running towards the defense before the snap, and you had the introduction of the forward pass, which, you know, for a lot of people at the time, it turned football into what they called grass basketball, or people later, because in rugby-based games, you're not allowed to throw the ball forward. But in football, they did that. And so part of the reason why we've seen such a tremendous progress in football with regard to safety, going from an average of 23 deaths for hits a season in the 1960s to an average of less than four a year, over the course of the last decade, is because the game does change. There's constant change with regard to equipment, with regard to rules, and with regard to coaching. And I think at this point in football's history, we should be celebrating that it's so safe rather than knocking the fact that it's more dangerous than we like it to be.
So you don't fault the new rules or the better equipment. You don't think it's wussifying the game?
No, I don't. I know there's a lot of voices out there that are saying such. And I think the big nightmare for football fans is that one day they're going to wake up and the players aren't wearing pads, they're wearing flags. In other words, the NFL has turned into a flag football league. We are a long way away from that. That's not going to happen. It's still a violent and rough league. And, you know, whatever rules that they come devise after the season, it's still going to be a violent and rough league next year.
So maybe the NFL's football game as we know it isn't under, you know, any immediate risk of changing, but you are concerned that fewer kids are getting involved in football at the school level?
I am, and to me, football, on every play, if you look on football, and I think everyone who's played the game has noticed this, that on every play, there's someone who gets knocked on their butt. And then they've got to make, you know, they either get up and fight, or, you know, they worm away and go on the sidelines and they don't take on the opponent. And to me, that's a metaphor for life. You know, in my life, I've gotten knocked down a lot, but the trick is you got to get up and fight. And so to me, football is really a metaphor for life, more so than how it builds young bodies. I think it builds character for kids. And unfortunately, over the course of the last season, youth football lost 6% of its player population. High school football, for the first time in about 20 years, is down. And so we have less kids playing the game. And I appreciate the concerns people have over head injuries. I mean, my own dad had a traumatic brain injury about a decade ago, so I know how difficult that can be. The reality is that the public health crisis facing America's youth is not about brains, it's about bellies. And 30 years ago, we had about one in every 20 kids was obese. Now it's one in every five. Football's certainly not the only way to combat obesity, but it is a vigorous game, and it is a great way, particularly at the youth level, to combat obesity. I mean, we think about, you know, football players weighing 350 pounds. That's in the pros. In youth leagues, they have weight limits, and the primary activity, if you observe a practice that they're engaged in over the course of 2 hours, is running. They run everywhere. You don't walk on a practice field. So I think football is a way to combat what ails us. It's not the problem. It's the solution.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Daniel Flynn. He is author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. And our first caller, let's take some calls. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Joy, and thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that the risk outweighs the reward is probably a non-starter on this issue, because college scholarships and glory and professional riches and glory appeals to many people. But football is not just a physical sport. It's a collision sport. It's two guys running into each other at full speed. And being tackled in football is like an unprotected pedestrian being hit by a car traveling 30 miles per hour, sometimes faster than that, depending on who's doing the traveling. And I think we should compare morbidity studies among other organized sports in relation to football, not just casual bikers, biking down the street and getting hit by a car. For instance, how many tennis players suffer from concussions and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy? And I'll take any responses off the air. Thank you.
Daniel?
Well, you know, the answer to that question is we don't know, because there's been no scientific studies done on CTE despite all of the media hype. One of the things that they're discovering with CTE that I find fascinating is that although 25% of the public has a certain genetic marker, about 60% of the people who they've studied with CTE has that marker, and this marker has been associated with Alzheimer's disease. So there's a question about what role does genetics play in the development of CTE. The debate over CTE is so broad in the scientific community that there are, you know, very respected doctors who are out there saying that there's no such thing as CTE. There's a guy at Loyola Medical Center who says that, Christopher Randolph. I don't agree with that, but my point is that the public understanding of CTE is very different from science's understanding of CTE. And last November, when the world's best neurologists got together, they issued a statement, a consensus statement on concussions in sports. And I think it's worth noting that the best neurologist made a point to say in this statement that there is absolutely no scientific evidence that CTE causes suicide or that contact sports causes CTE. It may be the case at some point down the road that we discover that this is the case, but let's not call speculation science. Let's call speculation what it is, and that's speculation. Just a real quick point on morbidity in NFL players. You know, not only were the NFL players outliving their peers in society, but there's a guy at Grantland, an ESPN site, Bill Barnwell, who did a study comparing NFL players to baseball players. NFL players actually have a significantly higher life expectancy rate than even baseball players. So when you compare the football players to other sports, at least baseball, they come out looking pretty good.
Yeah, but I think our caller was trying to say that you were, you know, comparing kids who play football to kids riding their bikes, saying that more kids get killed getting hit by cars when they're on their bikes than kids get killed on the football field.
Or falling off their bikes. They don't have to get hit by a car. I mean, there's 700 people in America every year that get killed riding bikes. Not all of them get killed because of cars. Most of them do. But there was one guy last season who got a traumatic brain injury and died from football. There has been one player this season where that has happened, and two players in both seasons died from collisions. 700 bikers, 42 skiers, 25 people mountain climbing, 3,500 people dying swimming every year. There's all sorts of activities that are a lot more deadly than football. Let's just put this into perspective. Two football players dying a year out of 4 million playing because of collisions. It doesn't even approach the collision deaths that we see in bicycling or something like skateboarding. I mean, last year we had 30 skateboarders die from collisions. 15 times the amount of skateboarders died from collisions than died from football. But no one's talking about banning skateboarding. And you hardly even see skateboarders wearing helmets. And yet they travel a lot faster. The playing surface is a lot rougher. And let's face it, SUVs are a lot more ominous than linebackers. So I just think we really have our perspective out of whack when it comes to football.
Tom in Rice Lake is with us. Hello, Tom.
Hi, I was just calling to comment. I totally agree with your guest speaker. As a freshman in high school, that was probably, I want to say, like 14 years ago, I got a stinger from just a practice game. I ended up getting hospitalized. I couldn't move the left side of my body for about 3 or 4 days, but I got over it. And my viewpoint on it is that they're blowing everything out of proportion, because I went on to do the physical therapy. Within a year, I was in better shape than I ever been. I still am in pretty good shape. I went on to letter 4 years in a row for football. And, I mean, I came from a high school where literally we had just barely enough to make one line. I mean, I played offense and defense. I played right tackle. I played nose guard. And, of course, the game is supposed to be a violent game, but it's not like anyone goes intentionally. I mean, I was in a practice game, and I got hurt. But at the same time, you learn from your mistakes. You go to take care of this, and this is just coming from high school. I mean, the people who are complaining about it are NFL people who get compensated millions and millions and millions of dollars to put their bodies through this kind of pain. And, I mean, I can understand to a concept that we're worried about people's brains and everything else like that, but injuries are injuries, and you learn how to get over it. You mean, you know, you stub your toe, you get over it. You break your ankle, you work on it. You know, you just got to learn how to take care of the game. And if I understand that they have in the new penalties for, like, spearing and, you know, helmet-to-helmet contact, that's a good thing. But, you know, it's a progressive sport that continuously gets implemented more safety equipment every year, more training, like when the kids used to get heat exhaustion and stroke out during the middle of practice. Kids are getting hydrated, watered, and just taken care of. So, I mean, I find it ridiculous that they want to ban a sport that's, you know, American pastime, especially here in Wisconsin. I think there would be way too many ticked off people if they tried to pull that around here.
I bet you you're right, Tom. But a stinger? First of all, what's a stinger?
Oh, a stinger is what I was told when I was in high school was the stinger is that I got a spine injury where it acts like a permanent brain injury but goes away. I think Mark Chimera had a pretty good stinger when he was, you know, playing football for the Packers. It's what I was referred to as a stinger. It's like a temporary disability based upon like a traumatic hit to, like, where the nervous center, all the nerves don't shoot off properly, and so it feigns an injury of, like, a brain injury.
Yeah,
so,
it sounds scary. It sounds pretty freaky. But anyway, Daniel Flynn, you agree with Tom?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think football is a rough game. Nobody's denying that. But it's getting safer. I mean, he talks about equipment. Let me just, you know, as an aside on the equipment, you know, during World War II, a guy named John T. Riddell, who founded the Riddell Helmet Corporation, he invented something called the Webb suspension helmet, which essentially a piece of fabric would prevent your head from hitting that hard shell of the helmet. And the federal government liked it so much that they conscripted it for World War II, and that was the military helmet. I was in the Marines for 8 years up into the 21st century, and the helmet that I always used was a Webb suspension helmet, that same technology that a football guy had invented back, you know, during World War II. Football itself abandoned that Webb suspension helmet in the early 1970s, and they went to padded helmets. In other words, the equipment that we use in football is 40 years ahead of the equipment that we're using for our soldiers and Marines. And I think there's something really pathetic about that in our country, that we equip our football players better than we do equip the people that are protecting the country. Now, the flip side of that is that's how good the equipment is in football. And one of the reasons you see the death rate you know, going from 23 a year in the 60s to less than 4 a year this past decade is because the equipment is so good in football.
Chris on Facebook writes, I think it's a game worth saving by way of some reforms and rule changes. Some may carp about that, but let's not forget that new or changed rules are nothing new in the NFL. There's real evidence of brain trauma in NFL players. I wouldn't mind some changes of rules and equipment that would discourage risky behavior. Response to that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, those studies that I cited earlier showing, you know, much healthier hearts and lungs, they also showed, at least for skill position players, guys at running backs and receivers, that there are elevated rates of Alzheimer's, there are elevated rates of ALS. Now, the fact is that less than 0.5% of the 3,500 players that they looked at, you know, died from these diseases. So it's a very tiny percent that are getting the Alzheimer's and ALS, but it's, you can't avoid the fact that at least amongst the skill position players, there's elevated rates of this stuff. So if you're talking about playing football in Pop Warner in high school and college, and then you go on to a 10-year pro career, you're probably not doing your brain any favors. I guess the worry that I have is that there's a large segment of the public that looks what happened to, say, Junior Seau and thinks that that's going to happen to their kid by playing Pop Warner. Now, the Mayo Clinic did a study last year on high school players at mid-century, players who were playing around Rochester, Minnesota. And they compared they did a mortality study comparing the high school players to members of non-athletic clubs like the Glee Club. And what they found was there was absolutely no difference in the rates of neurological deaths, disorders between the football players and the members of the Glee Club. And so there's scientific evidence that shows that, you know, if you're playing football, at least at those lower levels, you're not going to damage your brain any more than you would play, you know, doing any other high school activity.
Gordon in Wisconsin Rapids is with us now. Hello, Gordon.
Hi, good morning. Great topic.
Oh, thanks. You have kids who play football?
I do, yes. I have some kids in youth football in Wisconsin Rapids, the Wisconsin Rapids Raptors, and I just want to say, you know, my kid's been involved in it for 6 years, and the coaches are tremendous, and they really take good care of the kids. Top flight equipment, and they play all sorts of games throughout Central Wisconsin. And I've never seen any coaches take advantage of kids as far as putting them in when they're hurt or make them do the Vince Lombardi's Nutcracker. You know, they've taken just tremendous care of the kids, and it's it's a great program. So I can't say enough about it.
Yes, well, that's good, Gordon. Why do your kids want to play? Why do you want them to play?
Well, they enjoy it. It's anything's better than sitting on the computer, or watching TV. And they get exercise. They learn how to deal with people. They get their energy out, and they're good at it. It's a great sport. And, you know, we're huge Packer fans here in Wisconsin, and my kids love football.
And my kid's
extra large. He's a good offensive lineman, and my other one's really, really fast, and they just love it.
Well, good for them. They haven't been hurt in their playing career?
No, I don't think my son Joe is a big boy. I don't think he's ever been hurt.
Yeah, well, they're it's not discouraging Gordon and his family in participating, Daniel Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, he brings up some good points. I mean, I have a 7-year-old son, and if you know anything about 7-year-old boys, they've got a lot of energy. And I think one of the crises that we have in this country is that we're over-medicating boys because they have energy, because they're being boys. And I think rather than giving them Ritalin and Adderall and all that kind of, all those chemicals, you know, a good way to get their energy out is on a football field or on a basketball court or on a baseball diamond. And unfortunately, we have a lot of kids that are being babysat by Xbox or are looking at Facebook all the time or texting. It's become a very digital society. And I think a good thing for kids is to get them outdoors. A good thing is to get them on a playing field. And I just think it's a really perverse that at this stage in our history, we're trying to prevent kids from playing a sport in football rather than encourage it. We should be encouraging sports and not slobs.
We are talking with Daniel Flynn. He is the author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. He says football is safe and that these concerns about concussions and suicide and shortened lifespans of players are overblown. He says that the rewards of football outweigh its risks. What do you say? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Daniel Flynn, author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. And before we go back to the phones, Daniel, we just heard from Gordon, who says his two boys are in football and they love it and they're good at it. You say that this attack on football is more than an attack on football, that boyhood itself is under threat. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, you have, what is it now, 40% of boys who are growing up without their dads. And I'm not suggesting that a football field can replace a dad, but if you want discipline for a boy, a good way to find it is out on an athletic field, is out on a football field. There's this problem of obesity in the country with so many boys being fat. You know, like I said earlier, there was one in 20 30 years ago, one in 20 kids obese. Now it's one in five. One way to address the obesity problem is out on a football field. And I think as far as energy is concerned, there is a huge issue over medicating boys in this country and acting as though that there is some type of, boyhood is a disease to be cured rather than, you know, a time to grow up to be a man. And we give the kids Ritalin and Adderall. I think we'd be better off giving them a football. Let's get kids, you want to play a video game once in a while, it's fine. But kids are playing video games all too often. They're not outside enough. And I think a lot of boys, they need that fresh air. They need mud. They need physical contact. They need roughhousing. And I think if football didn't exist, some 11-year-old boy out there would invent it.
Yeah. Why do they have to have so much roughhousing? A previous caller also said, well, of course football is violent. Why does we won't watch it if people aren't getting, you know, smashed into the ground?
I don't think we would watch it as much. There's something to be said about violence in sports driving away viewers. I mean, of course, if you think about boxing or mixed martial arts, these are sports that, you know, boxing once was in very much in the American mainstream. And obviously with the money that Floyd Mayweather is making more than any other athlete, in some ways it still is. But really, you know, you have to try hard to find boxing. Boxing doesn't find you the way football finds you. And so, these sports are probably too violent for the American mainstream. I think with football, there are about four times as many Americans who say football is their favorite sport than, say, baseball, which is the runner-up. So it very much is in the American mainstream. And I'm sure there's probably some of your listeners saying, what's this guy talking about, a war on football? Sunday Night Football is the highest rated show on TV. And I don't think there is going to be an issue with football as a spectator sport. Football, professional football, is doing fine. The NFL's revenues are approaching $10 million. What I'm talking about in the book is football as a participatory sport that 4 million kids play every year. And football, as far as participation is concerned, that is hurting something awful, and it may be the case very soon that there's no more youth football left in America, and I think that's a bad thing.
Jim on Facebook says, football is foolish. It ties up school funds in local school districts that should be spent on teachers and textbooks, and it says it encourages a couch potato lifestyle in adults, those that are just watching the football game, and it should be outlawed or at least limited to children's touch football. Then we have Cindy in Burlington who says, football is often a route to a better life for many inner city youth. Many of them depend on football scholarships to go to college. If we take away football, we're going to take away their college opportunities. You want to just comment on football and the educational experience, maybe?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if anyone has ever read the book Friday Night Lights, they understand how perverse some school systems' priorities are when it comes to football, you know, spending more money on football coaches than on teachers and that kind of thing. And so I'm very sensitive to those criticisms, and I think, you know, in some parts of the country, certainly that rings true with the first fellow was saying in the email. So it's you know, when I wrote this book, it wasn't to defend every single thing about football, but it's just to say that, you know, it's we're a bit out of whack with our you know, we've gone a little overboard with the criticism of football, because after all, the game is getting much safer, and you see that through the deaths going down, and that football players live longer than their peers. The game is safer than ever, and the players lead healthy lives.
Let's take another call. We have Greg in Milwaukee with us. Hello, Greg.
Yes, thank you. I have been working with a provisional patent filing for protected headgear for about a year, and I have seen military helmets with foam suspension systems. I also note that military helmet harnesses to attach the helmet to the head are multi-point. Seem to be more effective in locking the helmet onto the head. I see a lot of helmets coming off in football games. And also, I'd like you to address the work of Dr. Ann McKee of Boston University, who has done a lot of autopsy work.
Well, first of all, Greg, if I'm understanding you, you think that there's better helmet technology that could be used in football that's not being used?
Well, that's what I'm working on.
Yeah. All right. Well, what about that, Daniel?
I think, you know, I played football and I was in the military, and I can tell you the helmets that I used in football in the 1980s were better than the helmet that I had in the military in the 21st century. It doesn't mean they can't be better, and perhaps the caller is going to do something to make them better. He also mentioned Dr. Ann McKee, who's one of the lead researchers at Boston University. And, you know, to me, what they're doing at Boston University, it's very interesting. You know, some of the scientific work that Ann McKee has done is very valuable, but I can't help but notice that, you know, they seem more of a public relations outfit than a scientific outfit, you know, chasing the cameras constantly. And they say one thing to the press, and they say another thing in their scholarly work. I mean, to give you one example, Dr. Robert Cantu, who's affiliated with that BU group, he just wrote a book called Concussions in Our Kids. And if you read that book, he says in the book that the concern over concussions and the connection with CTE has been greatly exaggerated, that the advice that he gives to his patients is relaxed. This is all exaggerated. That's not the vibe that you get from the BU group when they're in the press, particularly Dr. McKee. They have a documentary that they participated in called League of Denial that's going to come out on PBS in a few weeks. And if you just look at the trailer of that, it's amazingly sensationalistic. And Dr. Ann McKee, who of course has done autopsies on football players who didn't have CTE, says in that she wonders if not everyone who's ever played the game of football will come down with CTE. I just think that's just an amazingly reckless statement based on the fact that in her scholarly article, she even admits that they haven't done any randomized studies, that they've only done autopsies, and that the autopsies that they've done, in her words, have a selection bias. So they're not very valuable scientifically. So she says one thing in her scholarly articles, one thing in the press, and I, you know, to me, that's just lamentable.
Yeah, do you want to comment on the settlement that was reached between the NFL and the players' union, the class action lawsuit over concussions?
I think it was good for football to get that out of the way, presuming that there aren't a bunch of copycat lawsuits that come in its wake. I don't know that it was good for justice. I think one of the things your listeners probably don't know is that 10% of the players who were suing the NFL never actually played a down in an NFL game. These are guys who got cut in the preseason or who may have made a taxi squad, but they never actually played a down in an NFL game. And it just, to me, it requires a degree of gullibility that I don't have to suggest that a guy who played in Pop Warner, in high school, in college, maybe in other pro leagues, got a brain injury from the cup of coffee that they had in the NFL and not from all those other leagues in which he played in. So I think the suit against the NFL was largely dubious. I mean, you look at the players, they had replacement players from the 1987 strike who played in those three replacement games. They had backup quarterbacks, kickers who played in five games. I'm not buying the idea that they had brain injuries. This is not to say that there weren't guys suing the NFL who walked away from the game unscathed. There were a lot of players, you know, who suffered damage. But I think for the majority of the people suing the NFL, the suit was a money grab.
Let's take another call from Brian in Green Bay. Hi, Brian.
Oh, hi. The caller, or the guest you said earlier, said something about all the violence in the game and stuff. And I remember when he said that right away, my memories were right in seeing the photographs of him with a busted open lip, begging the crowd on. And he just wiped his mouth and go. They're kind of like the gladiators, and we root them. They get more violent the more we root them. But the injuries they get, the head injuries, whatever they get throughout the career, if they're tall, they're making the Bucs to stop playing.
All right, Brian. The line was a little bit fuzzy, difficult to understand, but he says it's, I guess it's the player's fault. They get a lot of money, and they got to take that risk. And we love it when they're violent. Daniel Flynn?
We do. I mean, that's part of the appeal of the game is its roughness. I mean, part of it is that aerial attack. We see Peyton Manning or Aaron Rodgers throwing these beautiful passes, and I think that's part of the game that appeals to people. But there's this more primal part of the game where you have a linebacker, you know, crushing a running back or a quarterback, and that's something that's going to get a huge cheer, no doubt about it, in a stadium. And maybe we should be embarrassed about that. Maybe we shouldn't, but it's reality. That's the part of the game that we love.
Let's go to Tim and Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good show. I really appreciate your guest's point about medicating kids. I think that's true. I do think one of the reasons it's I played football in high school. I have two boys that played football. One's playing right now. I think one of the reasons that perhaps participation is down is I think kids overall are just a little bit more lazy today because of media. They've got more options today than we used to have when we grew up, and that kind of distracts them. One of the things for football and sports in general, while I'm also in favor of the arts very much, is statistically kids in sports and school are always by far better students and better behaved and less problematic. When you have good sports in school, you have less problems a lot of times.
Tim, thank you very much. We're almost out of time, but what about the numbers are going down in youth football because they're just lazy, Daniel Flynn, not because of some war?
Well, I think maybe the parents may be a bit lazy. I mean, I don't know if it's because of the laziness of kids, but I think it takes some effort with parents to get their kids involved in sports. They got to taxi them to and from. They got to attend the games. And so a lot of times the parents would be more content putting them in front of a screen than driving them out to a practice. And I think that may be an issue as well, apart from the hysteria and the public relations campaign that's going on against football.
Yeah, well, we have just a minute to go. Are you optimistic about the future of kids playing football?
Well, you know, I'm optimistic. When you say the emperor has no clothes, people start to notice. And I think that's what I've done with this book, The War on Football, is that I've shouted out the emperor has no clothes, that football players don't kill themselves at elevated rates. Actually, the rate in society is higher, that football players, professional football players, actually outlive their peers in society, despite what George Will and LZ Granderson and Malcolm Gladwell have been saying. And the fact is that the game is dramatically safer, that there were 36 players that died at all levels of competition in 1968. There were two that died from football hits last year. So there's really no way of spinning those facts other than to say that the game is safer than it's ever been, and it's safer than a lot of other activities that parents allow their kids to engage in. So the game, no one's denying that football is a rough, violent game, but let's just get some perspective. And I think that's what's been lost in the debate over football is some measured perspective.
Thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate it.
Daniel Flynn is the author of The War on Football, Saving America's Game. He also writes frequently for the American Spectator and blogs at flynnfiles.com. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, La Lingerie, and Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, proud sponsors of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Associated House Rights, residential design-build contractors serving Dane County for over 20 years.